Welcome to Excerpts from the Open Forum. On this program, we'll hear Mr. Harold Camping answering pre-recorded questions regarding issues from the Bible. Here's our first question.
Hi, how are you? I have a few questions and a few queries that I'd like to pose to you tonight. For example, my first query concerns essentially the correlation between the correlation between quote-unquote sinful thoughts in the flesh and thoughts of acclimating oneself with human anatomy. For example, what I'm really trying to say is that essentially I'm an illustrator. I'm also an aspiring Christian. However, to be a proficient illustrator, particularly in terms of understanding human anatomy, one has to, of course, familiarize oneself with human anatomy and all of its requisites. All of its requisite manifestations, particularly, you know, drawing accurately a nude figure. However, I've had a bit of a conundrum in terms of having less than savory, salacious thoughts interfering in the midst of my study of human anatomy. How do you feel about me reconciling
that?
Well,
here is the problem. We live in a very sinful world. Sin is everywhere, and it's very attractive to us, whether we like it or not. And as a matter of fact, a lot of sin is simply accepted as a way of life, and we are so accustomed to it, we hardly even recognize it as sin. Now, the Bible's principle that never changes is whatever we do, whether we eat or drink, do all to the glory of God. Before we are saved, and we may think we are saved, and we're trying hard to live like a Christian, the struggle is very great because on the one hand, in our whole personality, we still like sin. And on the other hand, in our desire to prove that we are saved, we know that certain things ought not be, and our conscience is bothering us. But when we become a child of God, there is an intense desire in our soul, because we have a new resurrected soul, to only want to do the will of God. And if we persist down a path where our conscience is bothering us, whether where we are uneasy, could this be right or not, we know that the only safe path is to leave it out. It is in every aspect of life, there's us. There's things that we get into that we wonder, is this sin or is this not sin? And the only safe path is, if in doubt, leave it out. Now, you're saying, well, I know, but I'm an artist, and it's an integral part of my profession to know these things. And yet the very fact that you're raising the question indicates that you're uneasy about this. And frankly, it's like a musician. Yes, a musician likes to play all kinds of music too, but he knows there's certain kinds of music he cannot teach. He cannot be interested in at all. And this is true in every aspect of life. And sometimes it even means we have to change our profession because we find that we cannot have a clear, godly conscience and pursue this particular profession, even though that may be something that we are very skilled at or particularly qualified in.
I see, sir. Just one last question. Another problem that I've been facing over the last, 5 or 6 years has been essentially, in terms of edifying my faith, I found myself, incapable of, let me put it this way. As a result of actually,
I'm sorry, I still didn't get it. You find yourself incapable of which?
I'm sorry, sure. As a result of trying to edify my faith, over the last 5 to 6 years, I've found that my mind essentially had been besieged with a great deal of variegated thoughts and particularly ungodly principles. In short, my mind became quite clouded, and I want you to discuss very briefly the idea of how can I put this delicately? I suppose, for lack of a better term, quote-unquote, possession and or spiritual turmoil and its interrelationship to what is generally known as mental illness or incapacity.
Yeah, well, you know, there is a spiritual world out there, and we do have a soul. Even if we're not saved, we have a spirit essence, and therefore we are fascinated by spirits, and we are interested, at least in that kind of a world also. Now, the verse that comes to my mind as you're speaking is Romans chapter 12, in verse 2. But be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Now, how do we get a renewed mind, which also is a synonym in this context for soul? It is when we become born again, when we are a new creature in Christ. Then God gives us a new soul in which we're intensely interested in spiritual things, but only as they pertain to the Bible and not as they pertain to psychic things and the things that the world is very, very interested in, only as it relates to the Bible, because we know that out there is Satan's world and this psychic activity and spiritism and so on is all of Satan. None of it is of God. And so it boils back down to the fundamental issue: am I a child of God? If I have truly become saved, it means God has given me a brand new resurrected soul that'll never lose, that'll always be there, and will always direct me in the direction of God, and a desire to do the will of God, even though I'm still living in a body that lusts after sin. And if that is not the case in my life, that I have this ongoing earnest desire to do the will of God that translates into greater and greater obedience to God, it means that I'm not a child of God. And wonderfully, of course, it's still the day of salvation. You can still cry to God for mercy, and God is still saving a great many people.
Sure. I just wanted to make one last comment, and I don't want to tie up your lines any longer. Earlier today, I noticed that after a lengthy period of confusion and mental convolution and turmoil, I prayed to God, actually, and I'm not sure if this might help anyone else out there. I prayed to God, actually, and decided and asked to be forgiven for being essentially, quote-unquote, a Satan worshiper. I believe that I'm worshiping God, and I have believed that I'm worshiping God, but actually I'm worshiping things of a more fleshly, far more tenuous, spiritually tenuous nature. And I do thank you for your comments, though, sir, and thank you for your time, and God bless.
Yes, well, by your own admission, you recognize that you've been going down a very, very wrong path, and of course you can't get that corrected yourself. You have to wait upon God. But it begins with just what you're speaking of, a recognition of your own sin, that I have been a sinner. And, oh, God, have mercy, have mercy. And it doesn't mean God absolutely will have mercy. But on the other hand, this is a time of salvation. A great many people are being saved, and you could become saved just as well as the next person.
Mr. Camping, I had a question for you. Do you believe in that we should still keep the Ten Commandments?
Oh, absolutely. We have to keep the whole Bible and the whole law of God. But we have to read. We have to read each commandment and remember the whole Bible is a series of commandments or precepts or laws. It isn't just the Ten Commandments. And we can't understand any law of the Bible. For example, in the Ten Commandments, it says, "Thou shalt not kill." Well, we can't understand that unless we read the rest of the Bible. Can I kill an animal? Can a judge find somebody guilty of murder and assign the death penalty? Can a soldier kill in battle? Can we kill an insect? And so on. And so we have to read the rest of the Bible. And then we understand that command, thou shalt not kill, means thou shalt not commit murder. And that's true of all the commandments of the Bible. Every commandment, wherever it's found in the Bible, including the Ten Commandments, we have to read the rest of the Bible to make sure we understand that commandment. And that's why, for example, we no longer observe the fourth commandment, where it's talking about keeping the seventh day as the Sabbath and doing no work. We read about it and are blessed by having a spiritual understanding by what God was teaching there, but we don't keep it any longer, any more than we would keep the commandment of, let's say, Deuteronomy 16, verse 16, where God commands that every year, three times a year, all the males are to go to Jerusalem to observe the three big feasts of the Old Testament. We don't observe that any longer either, but that was a commandment that is recorded in the Bible just as quickly as the Ten Commandments.
If the fourth commandment is part of the Ten Commandments, then why are we not obligated to keep that as well?
Because
the thing is, as I'm looking at the Bible, I had a Bible study with someone about the Sabbath day, and, you know, as we were covering some stuff, you know, there was a lot of questions and a lot of things. For example, the fourth commandment, the Sabbath commandment, it's not part of the ceremonial law. We're not talking about the feast days. We're talking actually about what the Ten Commandments say, the fourth commandment says,
well,
remember the Sabbath.
Excuse me. Now, you said that, but that doesn't mean you can prove that from Scripture. If you look at Exodus 31, for example, God says that, and let me read to you, and here God tells us that this is part of the ceremonial law. He says in verse 13, and this is God speaking now, not me, this is God speaking. Speak unto is thou also unto the children of Israel, saying, verily my Sabbaths, and he's thinking about the seventh day Sabbath, ye shall keep. For it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that ye may know that I am the Lord that doth sanctify you. Oh, it's a sign. It's pointing to something, just exactly like the burnt offerings and the blood sacrifices and the laws concerning meat and drink were a sign. And then to make sure, and there are other passages of the same nature. Then we go to the New Testament, and we find in Colossians chapter 2, where God again is speaking about the Sabbath, and he says in Colossians chapter 2, verse 16, let no man therefore judge you in meat or in drink. They had to do with ceremonial laws, or in respect of a holy day, like the Passover or the Feast of Weeks or whatever. They had to do with the ceremonial law, or of the new moons, or of the Sabbaths. Oh, I see. The Sabbaths are in the same class with all the other ceremonial laws, which are a shadow of things to come. Now, you see, that's God is saying this. I'm not saying this. God is saying this. This is from the mouth of God. Now, you belong to a church where they are trusting that in your church, trusting in your church doctrine, but that church doctrine is not listening to the Bible. And so it's very important we listen only to the Bible.
You are listening to excerpts from the Open Forum on Family Radio. Mr. Harold Camping is answering pre-recorded questions about the Bible. If you'd like to hear more of Mr. Camping's teaching, you can hear and even download Open Forum broadcasts, Bible studies, and more. Just go to familyradio.com and click on Audio Archives. Let's continue now with another question.
Good evening, Brother Camping.
Yes.
How are you this evening?
Very well, thank you.
I was tuned in last night and I was listening to a discussion about Revelation, and it said whoever adds to, so on and so forth. Do you have any idea? We know John wrote the book. Do you have any idea when he wrote it? Because I have a list of some dates here.
Well, no. First of all, there are no dates given in the New Testament. We do know that the book of Revelation probably was written by the Apostle John. The evidence is there in the Bible. We know from the secular evidence, not from the Bible, that John probably lived to the ripe old age of something like 95, and that near the end of his life he was exiled on the island of Patmos, and that he... it was probably about that time that he wrote the book of Revelation. But outside of that, we don't have precise dates either. We can only be approximate. But the fact that that it is written, the book of Revelation, the way it is written, what is written, we have absolute trust in. And when God says we're not to add to the words of the prophecy of this book, we know that it is the end of the holy canon. There was nothing else that could have been written after that that became part of the holy canon, even though there are those who think that they know more than God and who are claiming, oh yeah, but the book of John or something else was written after the book of Revelation. Well, that's their judgment, but they are simply using their human minds and pitting it against the infinite mind of God.
Last night had made the point, well, you know, this is just this book. But then, you know, well, I have these dates. I have 96 CE, right? And then of course, John wrote three other books, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. And I have a date on those as 98 CE.
Well, you may
you
have.
Know, so, you know, that doesn't... That's after 96, of course.
Well,
and
but
it's,
excuse me. You see, you're referring to the very thing I was referring to.
Yeah.
There are those who claim to know more than God, and they have decided that the three books of John were written after the book of Revelation. Now, that's just not possible. That disagrees with the Bible. And so the question is, what do we trust? Do we trust the Bible? Or do we trust some people who claim to be experts in this business? And frankly, I won't trust any human being over against the Bible. The Bible is always the ultimate authority.
Yeah, that's what I see. And there's another thing, too, about Job. You know, they have Moses as the author of Job.
Well,
there's several books here that, you know, you can see... of course, the Solomon's Songs of Solomon. Solomon wrote those, and of course, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. We know who wrote those. And then some books in the Old Testament that of course, the names are right after. But there are others like Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. Moses wrote all of those. Is that true?
Well, let's first of all establish a premise. There are a great many theologians who look at the Bible as a compilation of a number of books that various individuals wrote, and they're brought together as the Bible.
Yes.
So they look at the book of Isaiah that was written by Isaiah. They look at the book of Matthew that was written by Matthew. And with that mentality, they try to search out when was it written, who wrote it, as they speak about each book. Now, and unfortunately, that kind of thinking permeates a lot of Christendom, a lot of the thinking of theologians. But frankly, what has not really hit home nearly as well as it ought to have, God is the author. God is the author. Sure, we have a book called Isaiah, and God spoke to Isaiah, and God, and Isaiah wrote down what God gave him. And so it's entitled the Book of Isaiah, but in actuality it is the writing of God. And so we don't have to speculate, well, who wrote this or who wrote that. We can sum it all up in one sentence. God wrote it, and And that's the mentality that we have to get into our heads, that God is the author, and therefore whatever we read in the Bible and in the original languages is super authoritative.
Well, somebody did a lot of research to get all these dates down. You know, it's about here, about there, you know, when it was written, where it was written, and all that.
Well, excuse me, they did a lot of research, but you have to remember, they're working with faulty documents. They're working with a little bit of information here and a little bit there.
Yeah.
And that's okay if you are not contradicting the Bible. But the moment you come up with a conclusion, any kind of a conclusion about anything relating to the Bible, and it is not in agreement with the Bible, then you know immediately we've gone down the wrong track. The same thing happens with archaeology. There are there's all kinds of theologians who will indicate, for example, that Israel came to its end in the year 722 B.C. because the archaeologists have concluded that. And yet, if you insist on that conclusion, it is saying, effectively, well, then the Bible is lying, and then the Bible has mistakes in it, because it's very clear that, and these same theologians would agree that Hezekiah began to reign in the year 715 B.C., well, 7 years earlier than, or 7 years later than 722, and yet the Bible is crystal clear that while Hezekiah was reigning, Israel still had its last king reigning over it. And so what they're saying is we trust the archaeologists more than we do the Bible. And that is a giveaway as to their spiritual mentality. They're not really trusting the Bible. And that's deadly. We must never, never fall into that snare.
I've heard you say that for the true believer, we cannot initiate sin. I was wondering if you could explain that.
As a true believer, we cannot initiate which?
Sin.
Satan? Sin?
Sin.
Oh, no, that's not true at all. The fact is that in our new soul, now remember, we are essentially two parts, and every human being that is alive, physically alive, is two parts. We have a body that is an integral part of our personality, and we have a soul or spirit essence that's an integral part of our personality. Before we are saved, it is the fact that both in our body and in our soul, we love sin. We think we know the answers. We think we're wise in ourselves. We may think we're very decent, moral, wonderful people, and so on and so on. But the fact is, God is not number one in our life. We are number one. Now, what happens when a person becomes saved? His body doesn't change, but he receives a new resurrected soul. The Bible speaks about being born again. The Bible speaks about becoming a new creature in Christ. The Bible indicates that in my new resurrected soul, I cannot sin, because that which is born of God cannot sin. Now, that means that in my soul I will never initiate sin, but I'm living in my body that has not been changed as yet. And in my body, I can still initiate sin. And when I begin to move in the direction of sin, my body will like it, but in my soul, it will create havoc. It will be a terrible burden to me, because in my new soul, I absolutely do not want to sin. And if I persist, God himself, who indwells me, will assist me to get victory over that sin, because he may begin to chastise me in order to give me help in turning away from that sin, because that is not the way a child of God should live.